Hey, gang, let's face it. You're probably listening to this show and all of the other shows on your phone. Are you tired of filling up your phone with all of your favorite podcasts? Well, you stream your music, you stream your movies, you even stream your pornography. Why not stream your podcast? Try Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is an app that allows you to stream over 30,000 shows right to your smartphone or pad. Get the very best in news, comedy, entertainment, science, and sports delivered right to your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. It's totally free. I use it and I love it. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get down.
You may ask yourself.
How did I get here? And now here is your host, Johnny Howdy.
When we talked.
All right. Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a fantastic show for you guys today. All right? Let me start off by telling you a story. In 1990, I was in a band in Houston called Panjandrum, and there was a lady named Kathy Waldman from a publishing company in Los Angeles called Emerald Forest Publishing. And they were interested in our band. And they were courting our band. And in that kind of thing, you kind of talk music with these people and you kind of develop this relationship. And I don't remember if they officed in the same building as Charisma or down the hall from Charisma Records, but she started sending me music and she realized that I reacted to sort of like this Paisley movement. She was friends with the band Lions and Ghosts. She sent me their stuff. I really liked it. And she was like, oh, you'll like this new band that has an album coming out in a month or something, you know, or in a few weeks. They're called Jellyfish. She sent me this cassette. It was just a burn cassette with the names of the songs on it and the name of the album, Belly Button. And I listened to it, and it changed it scratched an itch that needed to be itched, and it changed my perspective, and it made me realize that there was a style of music that I gravitated towards that I wasn't playing at the time. I was in a funk band, like in a funk rock band, not like a Chili Peppers kind of band, but like funk mixed with U2. It was weird. I don't listen to it, and I don't suggest anyone go listen to it. I don't think you can find any of it. Anyway, so Jellyfish changed my perspective. So as the years went on, I loved that band. I loved that album. And a few years later, they came out with another album called Spilt Milk. When I heard that, it totally blew my mind. Blew my mind. Seriously. So much so that the first listen through, I don't think I made it all the way through. It was overwhelming. There was so much happening. They had changed. The jellyfish from Belly Button had become a different jellyfish, a much larger jellyfish, a much more aggressive jellyfish. Still amazing lyrics. Still amazing melodies, still amazing songs, but they took this thing to a new level that blew my fucking mind. So I saw them on that tour with my band at the time, Mr. Rocket Baby, my friend Billy White, and his brothers Jason and Chris White. We all went, and it was, that show was life-changing. I had never seen people that good playing, you know, at Liberty Lunch here in Austin on the Spilt Milk Tour. Blew my fucking mind. Once again, to the point where we were talking about it years later, you know, still talk about it. Remember that show? Remember how they went, the whole thing blew my mind. So as the years went on, Jellyfish broke up, and I got their albums. Roger went off and started Imperial Drag with Eric Dover, and Jason Faulkner was making solo albums. So I followed them, you know. And I was into them, and I met a couple of them, met Jason, and at one point talked to Roger on the phone about working on a band together, met Tim Smith. And then when I was in the band Gowdy, we had a chance to choose someone to mix our record, and we chose Jack Joseph Puig, who was the co-producer and the guy that mixed both of the Jellyfish records. And I probed Jack for stories when I was in there, like, tell me about Jellyfish. What were they like? What do they do? I love them. So anyway, I'm nerding out. And anyway, everyone wonders what happened. This band made two albums, and then they broke up and they disappeared. Well, a few weeks ago, I was on Facebook, and I'm not going to lie, I like a couple of Jellyfish fan pages, so their stuff shows up in my newsfeed. And a book showed up called Brighter Day, A Jellyfish Story. And I was like, what? And it had a Facebook page. So I went to that Facebook page. Couldn't find where to buy it. So I wrote a private message and I said, hi, I'm Johnny. I have a podcast. And I'm a huge jellyfish fan. I want to read this book and I want to talk to the author. And then lo and behold, Craig Dorfman, the man who wrote the book on jellyfish, which is called Brighter Day, A Jellyfish Story, wrote me back. I bought a book, which you can just pay for on PayPal. So just go to the Facebook page, Brighter Day, A Jellyfish Story, and private message Craig Dorfman and ask him about the jellyfish book. So anyway, I wrote him. I asked him to be on the podcast. I got the book. I read it, and it is amazing. It told me the story of how they got together, which I didn't know, the story of Roger and Andy, which I didn't know, and all of the writing of the records, the making of the records, the touring for the records, the switching the bandmates, what happened to these guys afterwards is a great, there's just a great ending to this story. You get to find out what happened to everyone involved in Jellyfish and where they all went and what they all did up until now. Let me just read to you from the back of the book here. Andy Sturmer and Roger Joseph Manning Jr. met as teenagers in the fall of 1980. Less than 15 years later, the two of them had won jazz contests, written commercial jingles, become pen pals, joined a band with a San Francisco new wave icon, formed their own group, sparked a major label bidding war, recorded two critically acclaimed records, toured the world twice, worked with a legendary producer, and backed a Beatle. In 1984, they agreed that their musical partnership, as well as their friendship, was over. They shook hands, wished each other well, and left. They have never spoken since. Drawing on dozens of interviews with all of the major and many minor characters in the jellyfish story to create one seamless master narrative, Brighter Day, A Jellyfish Story follows the course of that friendship from its earliest days in Pleasanton, California, through two decades of silence in search of the answer to the nagging question, why, oh why, isn't there more jellyfish music? Craig Dorfman answers that question, and actually you'll find out if you listen to this podcast. You'll find out some stuff. Maybe there's some emails going back and forth between Roger and Andy since Craig wrote this book. What? Oh, yeah. Craig Dorfman is a great guy. He did a great job of telling this story, interviewing all the people, and being able to tell one story that is so deep and so great. If you're a fan, you will eat this up. And if you don't know who Jellyfish is, listen to their music and you'll want to know their story because it is a fantastic story. It's a sad story where guys alienated each other and built up resentment, and it was all silence until it just ended. I have a great conversation with Craig Dorfman, and he wrote a brilliant book. For a Jellyfish fan, this is a dream come true. For a person that doesn't know Jellyfish, go out and listen to their music, and you will hear a great, great, great story. All right? Enjoy my conversation via Skype with the great Craig Dorfman, my new friend. I sent him some music. Hopefully he enjoys it, and hopefully you enjoy my conversation with him. Here's my conversation with the talented and big jellyfish fan, Craig Dorfman. Let's get down.
She turned a nightlight on and blew him a kiss. He stared back through his green Crayola eyes. She chased his likeness from off the back of the disc. Next to the box top, promised her the biggest prize. Joining a fan club with my friends.
How you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm just looking for something to prompt my thing up on.
All right.
There we go. Actually, you know what? I just put it on top of a stack of books, like Brighter Days.
There you go. Is it literally Brighter Days? Hey, let me ask you a quick question before we get going. What is the main website to find the book?
Yeah.
Or do weirdos just write you on Facebook?
I mean, that's the most reliable.
Okay.
Method. Yeah, the best way to do it right now, or the best way for somebody to get information, would be to go to the Facebook page.
Okay.
Some of what we'll probably cover today is that I just signed a distribution deal.
No way. Congratulations.
Thank you. So the book, you know, pretty shortly should be available, you know, widely.
Okay, good.
I think not, you know, super widely.
Right, right, right. In whatever bookstores are left and on, is it going to come out like on a Kindle edition? Or have you done an audiobook yet?
I haven't done either yet.
Okay.
I have like pretty limited bandwidth to get anything done. And okay. So at this point, I'm just trying to get the physical copies available. But eventually, I'd like to get the ebook out. I've had enough inquiries that I feel like it would be worth it.
Right. All right. So let me tell you, as a Jellyfish fan and as a musician and just a guy that like wondered what might have happened to Andy Sturmer afterwards or like what was going on while they were playing together, this is an amazing book.
Thank you.
You did a great job.
Thanks.
What level of nerd are you? Like, I hang out with a bunch of pop geeks, but none of us have ever written a book.
Are we recording now? Show?
Yeah, we're in the
okay.
show.
I'm a music fan.
I can see that behind you. Wall of CDs.
So I think I'm a deep geek that way. I think I'm not the deepest of Jellyfish geeks.
Okay.
Like I love Jellyfish. I've loved their music, you know, for 20 years, but there are people who really sort of breathe their, you know, like I'm not sure I could tell you the order of the songs on both records.
Okay.
Off the top of my head,
okay.
You know, like, but what I was really interested in, really excited about was the story of that friendship. So the sort of reader in me, and I guess by extension, the writer in me was really interested to figure out like, how does a friendship develop from like, you know, 14 years old to like the most peaceful, but most definitive of all breakups,
yeah.
You know, like that just struck me as so profoundly weird.
Yeah.
That I really want. And then, you know, as you know, like if you Googled it, there was the same story over and over and over, and it was like not very informative.
No.
And so I really wanted to get to the heart of how that friendship worked, and how it wound down so peculiarly.
Yeah. Well, you must have been some level of a fan to Google
sure.
them and try and find out their story.
Mm-hmm.
How hard... Absolutely. How you did this took 7 years.
Well, from first mention to actual book was 7 years. Yeah.
Okay.
From first effort, was about 5 years.
Okay.
And in part of that, like the good 2 years in the middle, like I was moving from Boston to Portland, you know, like nothing happened in there.
Right.
So it was a 5-year project and I sort of don't want to over romanticize it. Like every day for 5 years, Jellyfish notes. And yeah, I was definitely like a very interested. I bought the box set when it came out, you know, like I was a hardcore, certainly among the more hardcore Jellyfish fans on the planet, but within Jellyfish fans,
right.
I was probably somewhere in the middle.
Okay. All right. So, how hard was it to find everyone?
It wasn't too bad.
No.
I mean, some of the, you know, like Roger is super easy to find.
Right.
And at least 5 years ago, he was still selling merchandise off his website.
Uh-huh.
And I had ordered, there's actually a third Mood Cookbook CD that was never widely released, but you could buy it from Roger directly. And so I bought that. And so I had his direct email address.
Okay.
So getting him was pretty simple. And then really like that opens up a lot. Cause once I could say I'm talking to Roger, then that gives the whole thing an air of legitimacy.
Right. Right.
And so everybody else fell pretty quickly. And then Andy, I think once Andy figured out that I was serious, like Andy, you know, kind of heard through the grapevine it was happening. And I think once he got the sense that I really meant business, he called me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I had left my contact with lots of people who I, you know, knew had access to him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the night he called, I remember this super vividly. It was like 9 something at night. And, you know, I was like getting ready for bed. My wife got in bed and the phone rings and she picked it up. And I'd been going for a couple months at this point. And I was like, you know, I don't know when I'm going to get to Andy Sturmer. I thought, like, maybe I'm going to have to write half the book and send it to him. You know, like, who knows what it's going to take to get him to come out from his spider hole. And,
right.
And so she picks up the phone. And she, you know, says, hello. Yeah, he is. Can I ask who's calling? And then her eyes got really big. And she turns to me and covers the receiver and says, he says, it's Andy.
Oh, shit.
And so I, you know, got on, I'm like, hello. And he said, hi, it's Andy Sturmer. And, you know, and the thing I was, it was as if the phone rang and somebody at the other end was like, hi, it's a unicorn.
Yeah.
It was so just totally weird. But from the very start, from that very first phone call, he was really cooperative and friendly and, you know, honest and kind, you know, like they're very super easy to work with.
That's good to know.
Yeah, I think the story had been told enough times in public and Roger and, you know, everybody else's version had gotten some airing. I think by the time I talked to him, he was kind of ready for people, like ready to let his thoughts out a little bit more.
So he didn't talk about it. Enough time had passed. Water had gone under the bridge. He probably didn't get a fucking, you know, pit in his stomach when he was talking about it anymore, you know?
I think they all kind of did.
Yeah.
Because there's a way that, like, you know, stuff that you think you've made peace with is really stuff that you've just found a way to get past.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I don't sit around most days thinking about how much I hated middle school.
Right.
But if you and I sat here talking about it for 3 hours, by the end, I would be really pissed off, you know, and, like, you know, yeah. And yeah. Feel like, I hope that fucking guy, like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So I think, you know, for starters, it was like, it was pretty easy conversation. And then everybody somewhere in the middle, like had emotional moments where like just old shit got dredged up. But yeah, he was, like even in that first conversation when he called, he started talking like right away. I still have my notes actually that I, you know, like at some point I like pulled out like a magic marker on a piece of paper and was like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
yeah.
What an awesome experience though.
Pretty great.
And then as you went through it. Mm-hmm. And you were catching up with all of the other like characters in the story. Mm-hmm. How did you find like offshoot people? Like obviously Facebook. Jack Joseph Puig and Albie Gallutin, these are guys and the rest of the band guys, but I mean the outside of that. Facebook?
Yeah, Facebook. Well, in fact the reason I joined Facebook was to write this book. So like that's how I got to So when I was in Boston, I played a couple times with this band called Minky Starshine.
What do you play?
Drums.
Okay. Oh, yeah, lousydrummer.com. Sorry.
Right. And Rob Anastasi, the main guy of Minky, had the first Minky record was produced by Ken Stringfellow of the Posies mixed by Chris Manning.
Okay.
And so I had said to Rob, like, oh, do you have contact info for Chris? And he said, you know, like, oh, just find him on Facebook. And I'm like, I guess I'm going to have to give in here.
Yeah.
And so I, a lot of contacts fell that way. Albie was actually hard to find. Cause he, Albie is like an executive now at Sony Music.
Oh, he is.
But like the executive vice president of being Albie. Like that's like, his, so he just like sits in his office and like thinks up, you know, like he invents stuff and like, you know, puts up interesting ideas and then he kind of like puts it to work and Sony backs him because they get the benefits of like Albie's brilliant, you know, like he's this sort of brilliant polymath. Right. And And so he brings plenty of value to Sony, but there's no like if you go to the Sony website, or you can't find any trace of him. And I called Sony headquarters in LA and they're like, we don't know who the hell you're talking about. Yeah, so it was sort of funny tracking him down. I eventually found him. Somebody had his home phone number, and I called and I got his wife. He was on the road, and I said, "Well, I'm writing about Jellyfish," and she was like, "Oh, you should definitely. He'll want to talk to you. Like, that's his favorite project."
Yeah,
and she was like, "Here's his cell phone number." And that was my experience with most people, that like once I got to them, everybody was pretty eager to talk. Like that, people who touched the record and are aware of it in that way, or records, like know that they were phenomenal, like know that they had their hands on something special, and were pretty, lots of people were sort of like, oh, finally, somebody who's asking me about this thing.
Right.
So that was a great reward for me also, a lot of times I just had to kind of, if you think about it, like drilling for maple syrup, like I just had to tap the tree and everything just poured right out. I was really lucky that
way. Yeah. I have a connection to them in a couple of different ways. And one of them is like, I guess at the time of after Eric left Imperial Drag, my lawyer at the time had been giving their A&R guy my demos, and then they got to Roger, and he and I actually had a couple of phone conversations about getting together and doing something, and it never materialized. But I got signed to Lars Ulrich's label. I was the first band that Dan McCarroll signed.
That's hilarious.
And when we did our record, we were going to mix it. We went to Jack because everyone in the band were huge Jellyfish fans, and Dan knew him and worked with him and stuff. So, and I ended up through him, I ended up meeting Jason and Tim. So, I love those guys, and I've been a fan for a long time. And I've even gone and worked with people they worked with just because they worked with them, you know? And Jack is a character. Did you get to meet him, or?
I didn't meet Jack face to face. We talked on the phone a couple times. Yeah. I would say of the major-ish characters, he's the, if I had a magic wand and I could talk to one person more, it would be Jack. I didn't spend enough time with him.
Yeah.
But he's super busy.
Yeah, he always is.
And he never quite knows what his schedule is, because bands will sort of just kind of, book him and then show up randomly and be like, we're ready to go.
Yeah, let's do it.
So I could never kind of schedule a time to talk with him, and I would just have to call with the recorder running, here we go.
Yeah.
But he's a character.
He is a character. he's like in the business of all the people that I've worked with, he's like, he has a dress. At least he did when I worked with him. He'd wear these velvet jackets with like these lace, ruffled shirts, just like this crazy kind of look at 11 in the morning at, his studio. So tell me about you real quick. Let's get some background on you. Are you a guy that's in the pop world? Are you a...
I'm a power pop guy, okay. I guess. I'm a lot of guys, but I think, power pop is probably one of the two or three genres where my bread is buttered.
Right.
And certainly the one that I know the most, if I was going on and, pick your subject trivia show, I think.
Did you grow up playing?
No.
Oh.
No, I didn't start playing until I was in my late 20s.
Oh, wow.
Never took lessons. I mean, lousy drummer is not like a humble thing. Like, I suck. and it's because I'm entirely self-taught, and I taught myself when I was 28.
Right.
but you know, but I have fun. No, I grew up listening. I think growing up, I it's fun. Suddenly it's turning into therapy. Growing up, I didn't feel hugely creative. Uh-huh. And I loved music, like loved music, but it never occurred to me that I could make it or write about it or, you know, like, and I felt like the best connection I could have was to be like a really good listener.
Right.
And then, you know, it's just one of those things. Like I also around when I was 28, I started writing professionally some and started to realize like, oh, there are stories everywhere. Like, in the world and in me. And as I got a little deeper into the career, I started to feel like the stories that were in the world are just waiting for somebody to find them right. A lot of times. And so, you know, it was a combination of this, like being a very, I guess, enthusiastic and detailed listener. And then, you know, a lover of stories, you know, just story arcs, you know, plot lines, and then feeling like some agency to tell stories and to write them down, sort of all combined to point to Jellyfish pretty quickly as like a ripe topic.
Yeah. Did you do any, like, what did you do before 28? What was going on there?
That's a good question too.
It's like a missing chunk of time.
Right. There's a comedian, John Mulaney, who's like this very sort of ordinary looking white guy.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, like I used to drink. And then he said, like, I mean, I know I don't look like a guy who used to do anything. Like, I was just sitting in a room eating saltines and then I walked out here. and that, like, that's I was teaching. I mean, like, yeah, that was my job. I was an English teacher.
Okay.
At a small, like, creative private school outside of Boston. And definitely, actually, like, that school and teaching did a lot to kind of unlock the writer in me. You know, like I being there and being with all these kids who were, when I started there, the kids were weirdos. And I say that like as affectionately, like in a great way, like I celebrate them as weirdos. And, you know, they became like artists and filmmakers and being around those kids, I got a different sense of what it was to be creative because I had grown up, you know, in this square kind of suburban upbringing. To me, creative people were like weirdos who lived in New York City and were dirty and, you know, sucked at everything else, you know, like, and were eccentric and, right. You know, wear underwear and, you know, like what it was just like that being sort of non-functional was part of creativity. And sort of being around these kids who in lots of ways were those weirdos, I sort of realized like the weirdness is another manifestation of it, but it's not that being creative is about creating things. It's about like putting things in the world where there weren't things before.
Yeah, that's exactly the words I use to describe being creative. Yeah.
And that makes it so much less threatening because it becomes less of an identity thing and more of a like, you know, let's try this and let's try that. You know, and I'd say that's the point where I realized, like, I think of stories all the time. I mean, I would say I think of a dozen a day. Most of them suck, you know, like most of them are terrible ideas. But I think my whole life they've been shooting through my head. And I always threw them out like I wasn't paying attention because I didn't think that was something that I did.
Right.
If that makes sense. And then at some point I realized like, oh, all I need to do is just like catch those things as they zoom through.
Right.
And and then certainly teaching writing honed my skill as a writer, you know, it made me a better editor of myself and sort of nipped a lot of bad habits. Like now bad habits that I used to have, I don't have anymore because I've seen them so often in teenagers' writing and have circled them on so many papers that I just don't do them. You know, like I sort of instinctively avoid them now.
Right. That brings a question. Did you have anyone edit this book when you finished? Or did you have to do that yourself? Or did you have friends or something?
Just sort of all of the above. I did most of the line editing I did myself. So there are a few typos still in there. And, you know, those are the days when I was drowsy, I guess. But I had three very, like, deliberate editors, basically. Excuse me. So one was a friend of mine who's a professional editor and a brilliant writer and a brilliant friend named Katie Guillen. And she was my sort of writing editor. I sent stuff to her and she gave me feedback on, like, this is unclear. You need a transition here. Like, I don't know what the hell this sentence means. And sort of she sort of made sure that the words that I put on the page, add up to a piece of writing.
Right.
Then I had a woman in Australia named J.D. O'Regan, who was in a band called Jane Versus World.
Uh-huh.
And she's currently playing with Michael Carpenter in the Cuban Heels out there. But she, it's worth checking out her music because it's awesome. And
I've heard that name, the Cuban Heels.
Yeah, Michael Carpenter is like...
Very recently someone was telling me about them.
Yeah, he's... that's like kind of a project of his. He's like this kind of... He's one of those people, like, he should be huge. You know, like, he's just incredibly talented, really nice guy, writes these, like, catchy songs, plays everything.
Right.
And he's, like, you know, just sort of toiling away at his studio in Australia. So JD, in addition to being a great musician, is a college professor of pop music. She wrote her PhD on Beach Boys. So I had her read it sort of as somebody who knows music and is a big Jellyfish fan. Like, she was the one that I was so the feedback I was asking for from her was, does this answer questions you have about this band?
Yeah.
You know, like, in reading this book, do you feel like, you know, like, I'm glad I read this book. It was, you know, it contributed to my fandom in a way that I want. And then the third person was actually Sarah Wirt, Andy's ex-girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
And I had her read it to sort of be like, does this look like shit that was happening as you lived it? You know, like, is this a fair representation of the world?
Right, because I bet you had to be cognizant of that, because you couldn't write that book from Andy or Roger's side.
Right.
Right.
Right. I mean, I certainly could have, but I really didn't want to.
But if you were cool and the guy that I hope you are, you wouldn't do that.
Right.
Okay.
That was, you know, that's funny. That was a big part of my early discussions with Andy, was me saying, you know, my goal is to, well, there were like kind of lots of kind of phrases that I returned to with both Andy and Roger and a little bit with other folks. I didn't want the book to get into like a he said, she said, or that basically I wanted to approach it from a point of view like everybody's experience was valid, and not like in a new agey, like everyone's experience, but that everybody had, you know, everybody experienced it in their own way and they processed it in their own way. And barring the, you know, as long as none of them are overtly, you know, crazy or like unhinged,
right,
then there's like, there's important truth in all of those things. And the story, like the story such as it is at the intersection of all those things.
Right.
And actually strike that. That's not entirely, it's not just the intersection. It's the totality of those things. Cause really, like, whether, you know, the say what Jason was experiencing at any moment and what Andy was experiencing at the same moment, there's what was happening. There's, you know, like some sort of empirical truth.
Right, right.
But also they were experiencing are both pieces of the story that are actually there.
Right.
And actually deserve telling. And if they don't line up perfectly, it doesn't really matter, you know, and where it mattered, I tried to think, you know, I tried to construct something that worked. Right. Or, you know, not construct out of whole cloth.
No, I know what you mean.
So what I said a lot actually was that I saw my job as not ripping open old wounds, but explaining the map of the scars.
Oh, that's really great.
Yeah, I was really proud of that one.
Yeah.
and that made, and it was like, and it was important for me to say, because it also helped, you know, like that was a good mission statement for me, was, you know, like remembering that what I was trying to figure out is how this whole thing fits together, and not necessarily like how to wind people up, or, you know, I'm not looking to get the band back together, although like that would certainly be wonderful, or anything like that. It's really just to figure out, like, just to put it all, put the pieces together into a whole.
Yeah. Have you, and you did a great, I mean, you really did, and the way that it's laid out, and the way that there's story, the way that the things that you focused on keep the reader extremely interested. And as a fan, for me, I was getting a lot of information. And, you know, from when I work with Jack, I got all the stories about how utterly uncomfortable it was to make those records. And that was reaffirmed. And plus you got the other stories. And this is a thing that I wonder if people in bands have come to you and been like, you know, there were times when I would be reading the story and sort of as being a guy that was a front guy and sort of the main creative guy in bands. There was one band I was in at around that same time that was a power pop band with like two main songwriters and lead singers. And you could, like he and I had that similar sort of like we were working together but not talking or hanging out. And like that same sort of thing. But I actually got an even better view of the guys that aren't the main guys, like the quote unquote drummer and bass player of a band, you know, at least in my case, where you would see things about Jason and go like, oh shit, I feel like I was probably doing that same thing to my drummer guy then. I almost felt like calling him then and being like, I'm so sorry. But it's funny because there was a question at the end of that book I had that was like, well, I wonder if this would bring them together and there would be a point where they would play at least a one-off show or something. But that's just total like fanboy shit.
Sure. And that, and you know, I would say like, so the two questions that I get most often are, what does Andy look like now?
Did you say Japanese?
What?
Did you say Japanese? No, I'm joking.
I might start there. You know, like, will there ever be more?
Right.
And the funny thing is, I don't know the answer to either of those questions. But certainly the experience was really cathartic for them. Or that, you know, that's what they've said.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea what they're going to do. Definitely, like, they communicated directly. Roger and Andy communicated directly for the first time and only time since 1994 in the process of this book, like sort of through me. And it was just like an email exchange. So, you know, there was a tiny little bit of thaw, and Roger is hugely busy and Andy is also hugely busy. And they, you know, they both have things they want to be doing, and maybe one day those things will intersect. You know, like I'm a never say never person. But I also am not in any way planning my life around what I'll do when Jellyfish gets back together.
Right, right. I do know a few people that would probably fly out to LA together to go do it. including myself.
Oh, for sure. I think people would come from, you know, worldwide.
I thought you did an amazing job of capturing what would happen to you, especially as a musician, seeing them live. Like, there's not a musician that I know that saw them live that isn't a huge fucking fan that still talks about them today.
Yeah, those live shows were really something, and I'm really glad to hear you say that. Thank you. I think that was as much as I was fixated on this story of the friendship, I was also aware of Jellyfish fans and what, you know, what they wanted to know. You know, like, there are definitely folks, like, I could have written 300 pages on their gear and, you know, and the mixing board.
Oh, dude, yeah.
And there are people who would have read it twice.
Yeah. You know?
Like, that's not the book that I'm capable of writing or at all, mostly because it would bore the shit out of me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I, you know, wanted to make sure that I wasn't just sort of talking about two guys who were friends. You know, I wanted to find out some about those songs. And because their live shows were so extraordinary, and like you said, like, the things people say about having seen them live were like these like quasi-religious experiences.
Oh,
like, people,
dude,
really crazy about it. And so I wanted to try and give that some airtime and see if I could drill down and figure out a little bit, like, how did, because, like, I've seen great bands, and I don't know that I've, well, I guess a couple times, but, like, I don't know any of them that so consistently have left this, like, sort of intoxicated crowd behind them like this.
Yeah.
And so see what I could find about that.
Oh, man, I remember I live in Austin. It's a music town. I'm part of the music community. I was in a pretty popular band at the time when they came here during Spilt Milk, and we all went and saw them at Liberty Lunch. And really, it was like, still people talking about that show. And, like, I remember the guys in my band and me going to eat after the show and just sitting there and talking about how they did this, All Is Forgiven, when they do this, and they back off the mics and, like, oh, we got to learn how to do that. Those fucking guys have this whole thing going on, you know? Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, it's funny, they didn't actually back off the mics. That was like the, I wonder if that did that not make the book? It's possible that that didn't make the book, because I got it really early on. But the rule there was stay on your mic as close as possible, and Shalom faded it by hand.
Oh.
Because there
maybe
was no,
that's why we talked about it, because we couldn't figure out how they did that.
That's probably right.
And there were tons of people around town being like, oh, no, they were playing the tapes, man. Oh, no, they were playing the tapes, man. Oh, no, yeah. No, that wasn't them, dude. No one can do that.
Yeah, that's they rehearsed the shit out of it. And they had Shalom, who's really obsessive about sound. I mean, like, he's a savant.
Oh, dude, yeah.
And that's exactly, like, if they had pulled away from the mics at slightly different speeds, like, that would make Shalom crazy. And it would have made Andy and Roger crazy. And so they were like, stay on that fucking mic.
Yeah.
And Shalom will make sure that we all fade properly.
Wow.
Yeah. And they were, you know, were on every detail like that.
Right. Hang on a second. My phone is ringing, because I have another. So there's a part. Speaking of backing vocals and the Spilt Milk tour, there's a part that for me turns into a horror story. And it really gave me, like, sweaty palms, because I can do regular harmonies and stuff. But, like, when you get into Beach Boys and stuff, I'm in a band where we have to do all that kind of shit. And we've done Queen shit. And our guy, he goes home and he records a version of the song and not records a version, but puts the actual track underneath, and then in Pro Tools, like, sings your part, whatever it is, and it's slightly above the regular thing, so you see where it is in context, just like they did, just like Roger would do with them with their tapes.
Right.
But that whole thing about, like, not actually singing an actual, like, third all the way through a song or fifth, like, just random fucking notes, whatever you sound good singing, and then you have to learn that made me, like, that, it was like... It's making the hair on my arm stand up because of just the terror I feel inside of having to learn that and do that. I don't know how the fuck they did that, man.
It wasn't fun, I think, when it comes down
no,
to
and
it.
No, and that's the main thing that I got from Jack. Because the other guys, I was always too scared to talk to about it because I thought I'd blow whatever thing was happening at the time. Yeah. But with Jack, I had plenty of time. And really, he was like, man, you have so much more fun doing what you do than those dudes. Like, you don't know how little, like, there was no fun. It was just bummer. Like, it was a bummer.
Right.
And I guess, yeah.
No, I think that's right. It was, they were so serious and so focused, and the result was, you know, like a fantastic product, but it wasn't at all joyful. I mean, like, whatever joy they had ended up on the tape and nowhere else.
Yeah, and the joy was for us, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Andy said that, you know, on the tour and during practice, like, Tim would walk around like singing his fucking crazy melodies for whatever the songs were just all the time.
Sure.
Because they were so random. He would just like constantly practice them so that they were in his head. And the first, actually the first person who I had heard it from was Linus Dotson, who goes by Linus of Hollywood. And he's a producer and songwriter and singer and like a, you know, also pretty great in his own right. And when Roger toured his solo albums in Japan, Linus was his bass player.
Okay.
And that was what maybe he wasn't the first person, but he was the person who like made it. That was the point where I was like, I get it. And he was like, you know, Linus was like, yeah, I mean, like I could listen to a song and pick out a harmony part and sing it. That has nothing to do with what Roger had me doing. It was like, it was crazy.
That's insane.
Yeah. And it's part of, you know, like it's a I think a particular gift of Roger's to be able to like be able to kind of visualize or audio-ize, you know, how each of those voices was gonna play on each of those notes, and then, you know, dice his songs up into these like crazy fucking things, knowing that at the other end it was gonna come out right.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah, that is just weird. In some ways, I mean, you saw them live as well. I mean,
I didn't see them
live. Oh, you didn't see them live.
I've
oh,
just
shit.
Seen a whole lot of tapes.
Yeah. Well, you saw that those tapes. I mean, he was right in some ways.
Yeah. No, he absolutely nailed it. I would say if I had to pin their sort of live magic to one thing, which would be ridiculous and unfair, I would say it was probably those vocal arrangements.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that's probably why they sounded so unique. Because I think, like, when you hear, you know, I've heard lots of bands with good harmonies, but I think when you have everybody kind of moving in step like that, your brain sort of separates, you know, like, all right, this is this guy, this is this guy, you know, like, and I think listening to Jellyfish, your brain couldn't do that because he couldn't track any one singer except Andy.
Right.
And I think probably that was part of the transcendence of just, like, I can't even... This sounds so great, and I have no fucking idea, like, how this is, like, I can't take it apart in my head, you know, and I think that's probably just magical.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever tried to play drums standing up?
No. No, I can't even play drums while sitting down.
You know, there was a few dudes around town during that time that started standing up.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So there's, silly.
Yeah. I think it worked real well for Andy, and you know, I guess there were the guys who inspired him, who apparently were pretty good at it. But largely, it doesn't seem like something you should set out to do.
No, it worked for a guy like Slim Jim Phantom from the Stray Cats.
Right, right.
That guy's rocking. So, okay, so you finished this book. Now you've gotten some distribution. It's going to get out. Do you think you'll be able to go out? I saw you did a reading and a signing at a record store. Do you think you'll be doing some more of that?
No. I would love to. You know, I think the signings really need to pay for themselves, or at least like kind of pay for themselves, like and the fact of the matter, like there's, you know, I did one here in Portland, so that, you know, there was no risk there. And then I did one in LA, and there, LA, you know, has the highest concentration of Jellyfish fans in the world.
Yeah, they saw them a lot, knew them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, you know, have worked with them since. Yeah. And so there was a good crowd there. And I think, you know, maybe I could pull something off in San Francisco. Austin might not be insane, you know, like that. But even like my family's in New York, and when I go home, I've never made any effort to book something there, because I think it, you know, like I know who I've written about, and I, you know, and I know that there are not throngs of people.
Right, but I mean, to me, they're kind of like the big star of our generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or at least of mine. Yeah. I don't know how old you are, but to me, they're our big star.
I think that's right. Well, I think they're in that category.
Yeah.
You know, I think about this a lot, actually, and in particular, as the book heads towards distribution, we're writing promotional materials. Like, that's sort of the way I've framed it. To, you know, as I think about like bookstores buying stock, most of them are not going to be all that interested in Jellyfish. You know, most of them are not going to have any background. So I've been trying to figure out how to frame, you know, like why would you want this book? And that seems like the best hook, is like, this is, Jellyfish is one of those bands.
Yeah.
And they are one of those bands, and I'll like stand by that. And I think like big star, I don't know, big star is special, I think. And, you know, and I think about like Uncle Tupelo, and Uncle Tupelo like launched a genre. And so like, I think Jellyfish were great. And there's a way that they're not necessarily, they're influential, but not necessarily foundational.
Yeah.
And I think other people would argue that they are, and, you know, I hope those people make that argument really successfully. Like, that would be, I would love for that argument to be accepted.
Right.
And I'm not sure that I'm the guy who can pull it off, but yeah, they are definitely our generation's hidden gem that, you know, like they just refuse to die, you know, those records just keep coming back and back and back, you know, like it's great. And I think really telling, you know, when you think about all the records that came out in 1993, not many of them are getting reissued, you know, and that for good reason. And so, that, you know, yes, I largely agree.
Yeah.
I might take some issue with Big Star specifically, but then maybe there are generations, you know, Emmett Rhodes or.
Right.
Whatever, you know, like.
Right.
Yeah, but there's certainly somebody special.
I like that you did the triumvirate of that era's power pop was Matthew Sweet, Jellyfish, and the Posies.
Uh-huh.
Mine would have been a little different. I think I would have thrown in Material Issue.
That's fine.
Of the Posies.
If I had to go with a fourth, it would be Material Issue. And well, and really, that was Bruce's three.
Okay.
I think they're probably my three also in terms of kind of influence, you know, like not just in terms of their music, but like like John and Ken from the Posies have played on like hundreds of other people. Like, they've done so much other shit.
Yeah.
And Roger
and,
too.
And members of Big Star.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Good point. So I think because the Posies are kind of so active at the controls of so many other bands, I think like they get up there. But Material Issue also, I think, was really something special. Like, since this has come out, I briefly kicked around a Material Issue book.
Oh, really?
Because there's a great story in there. And, you know, it'd be a lot of I mean, I can't say I think it would be a lot of fun to write, because I think it would be horrible and sad.
Yeah.
But I think it would be great to spend a lot of time with that music and.
What did they make? Three records?
From four.
Four.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So I think, you know, like, I think they're wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I got Belly Button, I want to say like maybe even a month before it came out, because I was in a band that I lived in Houston, but I was in a band that was being courted by a publishing company called Emerald Forest that I don't think is around anymore. But there was an A&R lady there named Kathy Waldman. I think that they officed either in the same building as Charisma or something like that. But she was like, oh, you got to check out this band. And that was the first time I heard them. And I just kept listening to the tape. I remember my roommate came home and I was like, we're doing it wrong. We're doing it wrong. Listen to this. So, yeah, I'm so glad that you wrote this book. I can't tell you, like, as a fan and as I posted a photo of it like on my Instagram, and there was a good chunk of people that were like, what the fuck is this? Like, tell me this is real. I really thank you. You did a great service to a great number of people.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Yeah. And it really feels good when people say that, you know, like for a couple of reasons. I think, like, one, as you know, like when you make something and you put it in the world,
yeah,
like you have no idea what you're, and especially like at this, I had spent so much time with this fucking book and had read it so many times that I was like, I don't know what it's about. I don't know if it's any good. Like, I don't know anything about this fucking thing except that it's a collection of words bound up in pages. You know, there was a little tiny part of me that really was afraid I had written All Work and No Play Makes Jack a Dull Boy 600 times.
Yeah.
And,
it's like,
and
the no, go ahead.
So to have that validated is really great. You know, like that people are finding value. And then there is something really special about, you know, like I love the power pop community and feel very connected to it. And to have like that community sort of, you know, to have folks in the community like thank me for adding to it,
yes.
You know, or feel like I've contributed something to it.
Yeah, you did.
Is extraordinary, you know, like that's, and I think, you know, I don't know that I had articulated that goal to myself, but I'm realizing like that was very much something that I wanted to do, was to sort of like be part of the not part of the cool kids, but like be part of the kids.
Yeah. 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 And contribute something to it. Like you're not just part of it. You're a guy that puts something back.
Yeah.
Hey, I have I'm just looking at this album. This friend of mine that was on the show, he's Mark Ford's son from the Black Crowes.
Yeah.
His name is Elijah Ford. Can you see this? Uh-huh. Elijah Ford in the Bloom. I could send this to you actually if you email me your I've got, he's gave me a couple of copies, but it's a great album. Yeah. I thought you'd probably like it.
Yeah, and if I'd love to hear the stuff that you've
sure.
done.
Sure, you know what? I'll send you a care package. You can just email me your address, and I'll send you a little box of music.
I would love that. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man.
That's actually also been a really nice kind of fringe benefit. I've been passed like a bunch of, like people have shared a lot of music with me, which is really great. I think. In fairness, I think there's a fair number of them that, like, because I'm the only person in public who, you know, admits to knowing Andy.
Right.
I think
a
lot of sort of like, you know, and if you happen to email it to Andy.
Yeah.
but I also am like very, very clear, like from the outset, like part of the reason my relationship with Andy works is that I, you know, am not an access channel to him.
That's how all those relationships work.
Yeah.
I won't pass your thing around to all my Jellyfish fan friends. Like if anyone's like, you know, if anyone's like a super dork, like he left this out, can I call him and ask him on Skype if he,
No, but certainly reach out through Facebook. I mean, like I've been loving
talk
fans and,
I'll post links and stuff to your Facebook and everything on the in the text and stuff of this and on my Facebook and stuff.
Thanks, I appreciate it. I've been trying to make peace with the fact that like I don't know everything, and some people do, I think.
Yeah.
So a couple of folks have like asked me questions like really like impressively detailed, like, you know, Andy said in an interview once that blah 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 blah. Do you know what happened with that? And I'm like, I have no fucking idea what you're talking about. I've never heard anything like that. In a different podcast, actually, somebody asked me a question, and I was like, I don't know, I've never heard of that. And then I guess Andy listened to it, and he emailed me, and he was like, "Here's the story with that."
Well, shit. Well, if you're listening to this podcast, Andy, hit me up because I would love to have you on, but I don't want to bother you. And also, I'm a little intimidated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair. He's a wonderful guy, and we still talk. It's a funny thing now that it's out. Because I realize, like, until the day all these guys die, or I die, or both, like, I'm now their biographer.
Yeah.
You know, it's like such a funny thing, you know, like we're like connected now forever.
Yeah. You're the guy that wrote the book.
Yeah. That was funny. That actually happened in a discussion somewhere. Somebody was saying something about the band, and I was like, well, I don't think that's really how it went down. And then I was like, well, I really think something, something, something. And a third party was like, no, this guy wrote the book on them. Like literally wrote the book.
Yeah. Yeah. What a great feeling, man. You did a great job. And again, thank you as a fan.
Sure.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope we stay in touch. And seriously, email me your address and I'll send you some music and stuff.
Yeah, I totally will. I mean, I'm down for swag. Thanks so much for reaching out. I mean, like it was great to meet you and talk to you, and I love talking about the book and the band and you know, just kind of, you know, like I like being part of the community, and I like the community being alive and healthy. So yeah. So thank you for what you're doing in that sense.
Thanks, man. I enjoy it. I enjoy being a musician and getting to talk to other people like yourself and other musicians. And figuring out how we all can put shit in this world where there once was nothing.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well said.
Thanks for doing the show, man.
Sure thing. All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Craig Dorfman. The man who wrote the book on jellyfish, Brighter Day, A Jellyfish Story. Go look him up on Facebook. Look up Brighter Day, : A Jellyfish Story. Get this book. If you don't know jellyfish, now you kind of know their story. Maybe get out there and get their music and then get involved. Listen to some more jellyfish music. I love them. They're fantastic. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you, Craig Dorfman, for listening to the show. Hey, if you're new to this show and you started listening to it because Craig was on here and you know Craig, but you don't know me, I am a musician. I'm a music fan. I do this podcast because I love talking to my friends and my peers, making new friends, doing this show. I put out, this is episode 536, so I've had a shitload of shows on here. You can hear everyone from Dwight Twilley to people you might not even know. People you might know, like Alejandro Escovedo. People you might know, like Frank Turner. People like Kathy Valentine. You know, a lot of people you might know, people you might not. All right. This has inspired me to reach out to the members of Jellyfish in some way. Anyone, Jason, Eric, Roger, Tim, Andy, if you are listening, my name is Johnny. I'm a huge fan. I would love to talk to you about you. Doesn't even have to really be about that much jellyfish. There has to be some jellyfish, but there doesn't even really have to be all about it. We can find out what you've been doing. I want to know what you're up to. I want to hear music you've done since then. I miss your voice. I miss Andy Sturmer's voice. I love his voice. I really fucking love his voice. I love his songwriting. I love his lyrics. I love the band. So thank you, Craig, for being the guy that wrote the book on jellyfish. That was weird what I just did, but it's true. It's true. I love them. And he did say that Andy might listen to shows, or maybe, you know, maybe listen to one. Maybe listen to this one. All right. Hey, thank you, Craig, for doing the show. Thank you, all of you, for listening. And go get this book, Brighter Day, A Jellyfish Story. All right? Maybe they'll get back together. You think they will? Have a great day, whatever it is you're doing. Bye.